Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
Hello and welcome to the Just Interesting podcast. I'm Robin and I'm joined today by Martin and Alex. Woo, woo, woo.
So, hello, Robin.
Unpleasant noise in your ears, but thank you for joining us. Today, we're back. We're back with a bang, and we're going to be talking about scientific terms that started as jokes or mocking terms, things that have now become common knowledge. And I mean common knowledge. You'll have heard of most of the terms that we're going to talk about today. But they didn't start as kind of serious scientific, this is the name for this thing because this describes the thing. It's just jokes. Just something else. But before we get into the meat of that topic, we'll be revealing facts we've learned this week. And before we do that, I'd like to know how you fellas are, because it's been a while. Let's start alphabetically. Alex, how are you?
I'm very well, Robin. Thank you. And yeah, no, it has been, it's been far too long. And yeah, no, apologies. I think there's just lots of life events going on at the moment. For our lovely people who are not just listeners, but watching us on YouTube right now, will be able to see that I have nothing behind me. This is the last time you'll see this backdrop. Well, I hope so anyway, because I'm planning on moving in a couple of days' time. So yeah, exciting. So we've just been kind of packing everything, and you know how much of a nightmare moving is. So it's just been all a bit crazy. But other than that, I'm all good. Very excited to be here chatting with you guys. It's been a while, long time.
Alex, just a quick question. Did you have more stuff or about the amount of stuff that you thought you had? Or has there been like, sometimes if you move, you get like mysterious stuff. You're like, oh yeah, like not quite sure why I got rid of this.
We're kind of like a couple of days out, and I'm like, okay, up until like a few days ago, I was like, I've got a serious handle on this, you know, I've got the right number of boxes, I've planned this. And then it's like, I open up another drawer and it's like, what the hell is this stuff? Where did this come from? So much more stuff than I thought I had. Yeah. But it's nice, actually. It's a nice opportunity to go through and clear out the stuff that you don't really need, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Birth certificates, wedding photos, you know?
Exactly, yeah.
That nonsense, yeah. Very good.
Wow. I mean, that is big news. So, Martin, how's your life been?
You know what? I was trying to think of if anything monumental had happened since we last, or at least I last, spoke on the podcast with you guys, and we come to the conclusion that no, nothing of much of note has happened. I put up some shelves, which I showed you guys, which was fun. But nice. Otherwise, stuff's been ticking along, which is good. I've enjoyed the Donald Trump and Elon Musk fallout, I must say.
Oh, wow. I imagine we'll be discussing that on our Patreon and YouTube member exclusive episode, a little more interesting later today. I mean, it has been a lot of fun.
I mean, Elon Musk, he must have been, a couple of grams away from revealing about the assassination attempt or the election.
Oh, you know. Grams as in posts on social media?
No, grams as in ketamine grams.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that is what you meant. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm kind of like a bit relieved because I feel like we've had several podcasts where we've predicted that the fallout was going to happen any day now. And it was kind of getting to the point where it was like, are we going to look a bit silly if they actually are just best friends now forever? But no, it was inevitable, wasn't it? You get two big personalities like that. You can't. Yeah. They can't. Yeah. But I mean, where does it go now, though? Because they've deleted, Elon Musk has deleted the whole tweet about Epstein.
I mean, that's silly, isn't it? He knows that everything lives on the internet forever.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean,
we can discuss this.
How are they going to try and walk back from this? Yeah, sorry, I won't. I'll stop talking.
Yeah. For all our wonderful Patreon supporters and YouTube members, thank you so much, by the way, for your support. It's been incredible, especially in this interim where we've had so much stuff going on that we haven't been able to do a podcast. But yeah, stay tuned and listen to our thoughts and share your thoughts with us too on Patreon and as YouTube members. Thank you. Facts we've learned this week. What have you learned? Let's go reversing the order we just did. Martin, you go first.
Thank you. Thanks, Robert. Now, I learned a little bit of history this week and about Napoleon Bonaparte, you know, famous for being... Mm. Nice bloke, civil, very tall as well, actually. And but Napoleon, I didn't know this, but he was once attacked by a horde of bunnies. Did you know that?
That's not true, is it?
Yeah, so he's defeated, you know, various armies, you know, with great military prowess, but actually, when it comes to the bunnies, he's 0-1.
Well, did he win? Did the bunnies beat him?
Well, I'll tell you what happened. So a bit of background here. So early in the 1800s, he signed the Treaty of Tilsit, which basically ended some of the issues between France and Russia, right? And they decided to celebrate this treaty signing and organise this big old rabbit hunt for Napoleon. And they arranged the event, and what they basically wanted to have was 3,000 tame rabbits to be brought in, caged, released for the hunt, and they would go around shooting them. I mean, it sounds like a bit of an easy one, doesn't it, really, 3,000 rabbits? But anyway, Napoleon arrived with his people, his little party, his hunting party, and when they let all the rabbits out of the cages, what the rabbits are meant to do is, like, run away, right? They're meant to run away and scatter, and then you go after them. But what happened was all the rabbits came out, and they all ran towards Napoleon and his men, because the person who organized the hunt didn't source wild rabbits. They gathered domesticated rabbits that are associated with humans with food. So they thought that Napoleon was going to bring them some lunch. And of course, No, they weren't. And so some of them climbed up his coat. His carriage had to be brought in so he could make a strategic withdrawal from these bunnies. So he went around telling this story to lots of his generals about the one time he had been outmaneuvered by these fluffy bunnies.
That's incredible. That's hilarious.
But going, the question is that really true? It's his story, right? He's a great orator, charismatic person, egotistical. He might have made it up to make a point, but I like to think that it's true in some capacity.
Do you think the British ever got wind of that story? We're just like, if we dress our men as bunny rabbits, maybe.
It's just a furry attack.
the PTSD will strike Napoleon dumb and he won't be able to respond to our attack. I'm sure they never seriously considered that.
But they could have.
They could have. I mean, they were desperate at some point, right? Napoleon was like,
yeah.
Wow. That's a great story.
It's interesting that he wasn't so arrogant that, like, or narcissistic that he couldn't even allow to tell that story, you know, of the time that he was beaten by bunnies. Like, he could see the humor in it. And, like,
yes.
I don't know. Yeah, no, exactly. I've always kind of imagined him as someone who couldn't even, like, joke about that. Like, no, I would have beaten the bunnies if they let me.
I mean, yeah, to be fair, I've always imagined him as a very humorless person, you know, really dead serious. But that shows he does have a sense of humor, which is nice. And I guess he must have been a likable person to a certain extent. All these big dictators tend to be fairly charismatic. Therefore, he must have had his charms.
Yeah. I mean,
Sorry, no, go on.
Even the most serious dour people tend to, there's tend to be a side of them that has a sense of humor at least some point in their lives, right? It's very rare you have somebody who's completely humorless.
Yeah, that's true. It's true. What have either of you seen the recent Ridley Scott one with him?
No,
Joaquin Phoenix?
No.
No, not yet.
No, I haven't. No. I'm surprised. I thought you would have both been on it.
Oh no, I'd love to
hear your opinions.
Fatherhood has completely removed my ability to watch films. And isn't it on Apple
Fair
anyway?
Enough.
So it's like, I'm not going to do
that. Oh, is it? Oh,
I think okay. It's an Apple
Fair enough.
TV.
Oh, is it? I see. Right.
Well, if anyone in the comments has seen it, then let us know. Is it worth watching?
Well, that's the other thing. Everyone else, everyone I've heard who's seen it says don't.
So, yeah.
I think it was. I think
they show him quite, firing cannons at the pyramids, which is bizarre on several levels, because on the one level, Napoleon never did it. On the other level, no one ever did it. There's no cannon fire damage on the pyramids. It's like, why did you do that? Why did you add that? What a strange thing to do.
Yeah.
Although, didn't we talk about someone basically blowing holes in the head of the Sphinx at one point?
Yeah.
Yes, that's
on
true.
The podcast, didn't
yeah, some archaeologists decided, I'm going to use dynamite on this thing. Yeah.
Well, they wanted to see if there was anything inside, so they just kept digging and there was just nothing.
Yep, yeah. There are big holes and cavities in the Sphinx, some of which are definitely man-made. People really determined to find out what's inside. Yeah. At some point, you've got to, well, they did stop, I guess. Yeah. But how, if you're in that situation and you're digging, like, there's a big statue made of apparently solid stone, but there's definitely something inside, so I'm just going to dig a hole and keep digging.
So it's not a kindering, mate.
At a certain point, you're like, when do you stop? Or just keep going until you've reached the other side of the earth? Anyway, speaking of ancient monuments, the fact that I've learned this week is also a historical one, Martin. So it's about ancient Alexandria and the lighthouse, which was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Although not originally, apparently there's like several lists, and the first list did not include the lighthouse. The lighthouse was added later after it had been around for 100 or 200 years.
It was the last edition one. It was the we need another one for the list, don't we? I guess.
Well,
it's
seven,
not
Jeremy.
Exactly as good as the other one, but the other one's on the list.
The previous number seven, yeah. Well, apparently they still don't know what the fuel was that they used for the lighthouse, because nobody at the time ever bothered to write down what fuel they used. But it's in Alexandria, which is at the tip of the northern coast of Egypt. But it was built on basically a swamp. Alexander the Great came along, saw that there was this really strategically useful harbour, and said, oh, I'm going to build a city here. And it was basically on a swamp, so they drained the swamp and then built the city. Although actually the city was built on canals, so there's lots of running water underneath the city. Anyway, the point is that because it was built on a swamp, there was no woods or forest or anything nearby. And as you know, Egypt as a whole isn't famous for its lush greenery. So wood was in short supply. It was very rare. So they think, well, they weren't burning wood probably, unless they imported it, but that's kind of weird to import wood. So what did they burn instead? Well, the Egyptians used papyrus bundles. They used to bundle it up and use that for wood fire, but that would just be like a little hearth fire. You want a lighthouse fire to be bright. And we know from contemporary descriptions that the lighthouse was, people compared it to the light of the moon or the light of the sun. So it was really, really bright.
Wow.
So they still don't know what they used. And they speculate that maybe they used, I think, something called naphtha, which is like a precursor to napalm. but from Persia. Okay. And that's like so expensive. It's kind of like a bit implausible that they would have used that every day, for the light.
So
they're not really sure what they used as fuel.
I'm just going to chuck it out there.
Yeah.
Did they use electricity and fluorescent light bulbs?
There you go.
Just saying.
Yeah.
Just saying.
Energy savers.
They
actually pretty well bright enough.
They used the stuff from Atlantis. That's what they did. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Oh. I mean, just don't rule it out. That's all I'm saying.
It's a mystery to be solved. Also, the thing I learned about, and this makes sense, but I don't know if you guys ever think about this kind of thing. Ancient Alexandria, this was built, Alexander the Great lived in 330-ish BC, which is nearly 2,500 years ago. And that's when the lighthouse was built, in the decades after his death. And the lighthouse was still standing in the 15th century.
It's because mad, isn't
people
that's
wrote
crazy.
About going up there and seeing it. And that's kind of like, whoa. And it fell down because of an earthquake. And it's just extraordinary to think that it was there for that long.
People How still, tall was it?
Like 100, over 100 meters. Taller than Statue of Liberty.
Wow.
It was huge. Wow. Absolutely humongous.
Yeah.
It was like a big building.
It's a shame we don't get a chance to see it.
I know. Yeah. If only we could go back there. But yeah. Nope. Anyway, that's what I learned this week.
Nice. That's really Excellent. Interesting. Thanks, Robin.
Why, thank you. What did you learn this week, Alex?
Well, I'm glad that you've both done topics that are kind of more broad, because I've got like quite a niche one that's only going to be very interesting to a subset of our audience, I think. And I actually owe this fact to another YouTuber who's, I saw this video a few weeks ago and I thought, damn, that's interesting. But yeah, I'll credit them. It's Chris Spargo. I don't know if either of you watch his videos. Okay. This was an interesting fact, and one I've always wondered, actually, because the supermarket that I used to go to had this, and I didn't really understand why. But have you, either of you ever noticed that UK supermarkets often have like a clock tower, like in the kind bigger supermarkets that are normally just outside of the town centre? Mm. And it's kind of a bit random. Why are they like that?
Yeah. Even the new build
and
ones
it's exclusive.
It sometimes,
Yeah.
They often have a clock tower, and the clock tower never works. It's not really like a functional thing. It's just there for like a design. So I was, the reason why this used to happen was when supermarkets started taking off in like the 60s, the designs that they had that were kind of imported from America into the UK were like these big kind of ugly industrial buildings. And obviously putting that in like a cutesy villages and stuff and these historic towns, no one really liked them. No one liked the style of them. And in 1977, in Essex, there was a new town being built, South Woodham Ferrers. And they had a very specific style requirement for that town, which was basically any new building needed to match the aesthetic of the town. And a few miles away, there was like a barn, this barn and clock tower structure. Anyway, the designers made this into a supermarket. This was an Asda supermarket that became this like, it even has its own style now, like this specific style building named after this. But it's, so they made it out of this to fit this very specific Essex town. And they were like, and people loved it. It was great, a good success, you know. And they took from that lesson that what they should do for every other UK town is not base it on whatever style that town is, but just to take the one in Essex and copy and paste it all across the UK. So now, there are these supermarkets that were built in like the 70s and 80s that are all based on this, you know, South Woodham Ferrers style, style of town.
It's bizarre, though, isn't it?
It's just bizarre. Like, how did they learn that? Take that lesson away from us. but these are kind of going out of style now. Now are, I think, in 2025, we don't really care anymore, and all the massive supermarkets just have that kind of like standard glass exterior aesthetic.
But they're even worse, though, because they're like, at least where I live, they seem to be superstores, and they're like several stories high, and they're just massive. They almost look like airports from the outside, which is not a flattering comparison I'm trying to make.
Yeah.
It's a shame. Yeah, bring back the quaint tiled roofs and the clock towers, please.
It's so weird, though, because it's like, on a lot of them, it tends to be kind of more roof than supermarket.
They've got
so much roof. It's like, where's this all coming from? How much do you spend on like a slate?
It's bizarre. But there's something I've always kind of wondered, like, because especially they just don't fit in. The idea with them was to make them fit into the town. You see them and they just stick out. Like, why did they build it like that in this town?
I guess amongst UK residents, though, we're so used to having the clock tower that it's like, You don't even think about it.
Yeah, that's true. But yeah, I mean, I think there are some supermarket chains that do carry this on when they're building new ones. I think Morrison's does it.
I was literally
like, they have their own
Morrison's
kind of modern variant of it, where they still have a build a clock tower along with their new supermarkets. But I mean, yeah, it's an interesting quirk, I guess. Well, I hope it's interesting anyway. I'm sorry
it
if
is
that's
interesting.
Not interesting.
And now I have to admit, Alex, you've made me much more attached to the concept than I ever thought I would be. Now that I know it's a thing and there's a story behind it, I kind of want it to continue. So thank
petition.
You.
Petition, yeah.
The petition starts now. Yeah. Bring back the clock towers. But only on
Yeah, that's what I learned this week. And thank you to Chris Spargo. Go and watch his video on it because it's really interesting and it's only like 4 minutes long. So, yeah.
Wow, that's a bold move in this era of YouTube.
Yeah.
All right. Oh, well, thank you, fellas. That was really, really fascinating. And now on to the main topic, which is scientific terms that began as jokes.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
And here we are, scientific terms that started as jokes, which in itself might have begun as a joke suggested by one of us and then thought, oh, there's actually some meat to this topic. So here we go. Who wants to kick us off? Or shall we just start with like a nice obvious one that people may have heard of before?
It depends how we want to go about this. I mean, we could chronologically start from the beginning.
That sounds like a good one. Take it away.
Okay. I will start with a man called Fred Hoyle. Have you ever heard of Fred Hoyle? Sir Fred Hoyle? He was an astrophysicist. And he quoted something very famous in the 1940s. So in 1949, he was talking to the BBC's Third Programme, which is basically a radio show, academic radio show. So what would typically be on Radio 4 probably now for those in the know. And he was talking specifically about the theory of the beginning of the universe. And specifically what he said was, he said, well, to start with, he was promoting his own theory, which was called the steady state theory. Okay. And this theory was that the universe basically had no beginning or end, and that new matter was continuously being created as the universe expanded. And what he quoted, what he said was, these other theories, he's talking about other people's theories, suggest that all matter in the universe was created in one big bang at a particular time in the remote past. And of course, the big bang theory is very much the leading theory when it comes to how the universe started. And so his original, I guess you'd call it mocking, right? He's mocking, he's being dismissive.
One big bang, yeah.
One big bang, like it was stupid. trying to make it sound, I guess, pretty absurd, like a big old explosion. Stuck. This name stuck. And of course, scientists then quickly adopted it because it's pretty simple, it's pretty memorable. And his own theory, of course, which the steady state theory, I mean, no one knows about the steady state theory, of course, it lost its credibility and the Big Bang stuck.
I think that counts as a backfire, doesn't it? She's trying to, it does a little trying to bit. Talk it down, yeah. And you end up giving the name to the thing that everybody remembers now, because it's called the Big Bang Theory. It's funny exactly. as well, because I remember when learning about the Big Bang Theory and thinking that, because the one thing they always insist on is like, it's not an explosion, it's a rapid expansion from a point of singularity. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, so why did you call it the Big Bang? What's about that? But now I know that's why.
Yes, yes.
It's much more suited to a TV sitcom name than an actual scientific theory, isn't it?
Yeah, he gets no royalties, I guess. The estate, Fred Hoyle's family get no royalties for that.
No, I imagine not. No, yeah.
Hmm. Yeah.
Oh, what a shame.
Yeah. Do you know what? I've heard, like, I've never actually thought about that as, like, what's crazy is, like, you associate these as scientific, some of these as, like, scientific terms. So, like, I've never thought how ridiculous a name the Big Bang Theory actually is. But it is kind of ridiculous, like, thinking about it. But I don't know, because I'm like, oh, the scientists named it. It must be, like, you know, smart. They must have a smart reason for doing that.
But yeah, it's such a kind of informal name, Big Bang.
Yeah,
and it is ridiculous. It's like even the
for
word
the theory of the origin of the universe.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's funny how when used in a derogatory way, the word big is actually reductive. You know,
yes,
it's very kind of ironic there, and in a way clever, but obviously it didn't work for him. So yeah. There's another, in a similar vein, actually, one that I'd like to talk about is something that any of our mathematicians in the audience, any listeners who like maths, who do maths, anybody who studied maths, because I think most of us get taught algebra at school, and you've probably come across the term imaginary numbers, which are, and please, Alex and Martin, help me out here. Imaginary numbers are numbers that are the opposite of real numbers, and real numbers are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, going on into infinity, which is you can count things in the real world that you can hold in your
exist.
Hand using real numbers. Yeah. And if you can multiply, subtract, divide, and whatever, and you always get a result, which is still a real thing. So if you get, if you have two apples in your hand and you eat one of them, you deduct one from two and you get one. Those are all real numbers because you've still got a real apple in your hand. And imaginary numbers are the negatives. So you can't hold minus two apples in your hands. So it's an imaginary number. But the reason it's called imaginary numbers, because obviously in maths, negative numbers are a huge part of maths and algebra uses them a lot. And you can multiply them by each other. You can have squared negative numbers. And I think the result of a negative squared is always a negative answer. Is that right? Like minus 5 times minus 5.
Yes.
Minus 5 times minus 5 is actually 25.
That's 2. That's 2, isn't it? Yeah.
So
we've gone beyond my maths knowledge.
Yeah, it's all confusing. Well, that's the point.
I'm out on a ledge. I don't know what I'm doing.
Once you get below zero, and some mathematicians would argue, including zero, you're in the realm of imaginary numbers because they just don't exist in the real world as we perceive it. And that name is apt because none other than René Descartes came up with the name imaginary numbers very much as a mocking term to mathematicians of the 18th century who were trying to play around with negative numbers and figure out the maths of how they worked. And he was just like, what are you doing? This is a waste of time fooling around with these imaginary numbers. And then it stuck. And all the scientists from the 19th century onwards are like, yeah, that's a good name, imaginary numbers.
It's a good name for it. That's the key thing about these when it comes to the naming is just, they're memorable, aren't they? The Big Bang, imaginary numbers. They're all things that they stand out, even if they're not like bang on in terms of like a descriptor, they're memorable.
Yeah.
Science is a fairly good line in memorable names.
Yeah.
I think.
Boaty McBoatface.
Yep. There you go. Science.
Science. Scientific poll. Yeah. Well, another one that I'd like to talk about, and this is kind of a common theme I've seen with lots of these that end up being about pop culture references finding their way into science. And so I'd like to introduce both of you to the Sonic Hedgehog protein. Based off of, I don't know. It's a pure coincidence that it sounds like the Sega character. But this, the SHH, is a signaling protein that plays a critical role in embryonic development. And I think the team of researchers who discovered this actually won a Nobel Prize for it.
No way.
In the 70s, 80s.
So when they were awarding the Nobel Prize, did they say, for the discovery of the SHH protein? Because that sounds a bit more serious.
Well, I mean, there's actually like, the thing is, like, this is, you know, about the development of cells. And I think it helps tell molecules and cells to develop in the right shapes, basically. That's what this does. So there is like a kind of dark side to this, because if like, you know, people like having to tell a family that their child's not going to, you know, live for very long past birth because they have a defect in the sonic hedgehog signaling pathway is not a good look, to be honest.
That's awful.
So yeah, I imagine in that situation they describe it as the SH pathway. Yeah.
I'm afraid he's not gonna live. Sonic the Hedgehog.
Yeah, so it can be kind of dark. But in case
they should think about that when they start. They should think about that. Right.
Well, so apparently there's actually like a whole family of hedgehogs in this as these molecules, because there's a whole group of hedgehogs and they got their name because they're spiky looking. So the common ones in vertebrates are sonic hedgehog, Indian hedgehog, and desert hedgehog. And I think they were discovered in like fruit flies.
Doesn't make it much better, does it? Freddy's got the desert hedgehog gene.
No. Oh, sonic hedgehog is the best name though, but yeah, there you go.
I thought you were going to say Amy and Shadow were the other names.
Did you know that in the
Knuckles
in the original Japanese versions, Tails was called Miles, which is a fact. Wow.
Lovely.
Interesting though. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Shall I go into my
my
second one? Okay, so the next one I'm going to bring to the table is a term that's used often for thinking freely, even thinking with a paradigm shift ultimately. And what I'm doing now is I'm using terms that are quite vague, because of course, blue sky thinking, by its very nature, is quite vague.
Yeah.
And blue sky thinking originally was used as a derogatory term. So where did blue sky thinking come from? So the earliest term for blue sky thinking appears in like business and management circles in like the 1950s and 1960s. There isn't actually a specific origin for it, but it's around that time. And likely evolved from the blue sky laws in the US. This was in the early 20th century, which referred to laws against selling fraudulent or speculative investments. So it really has quite negative connotations, blue sky thinking being basically a bit of a con. Whereas now, of course, blue sky thinking refers to kind of creative, unbounded ideas, if you want to use that term. So, you know, brainstorming in both the arts but also in the sciences without constraints, and it's used.
Aren't there like whole departments, people who get paid to just do that right now?
Yeah,
that's the thing. Yeah,
absolutely. So yeah, problem solving, coming up with innovative solutions and ideas for like, you know, products but also scientific discoveries. And so this is like a huge part of like I guess, modern day creativity, if you want to call it that, business innovation. You know, we're talking about innovations in technology, in science, research and development, all these different things are related to kind of the blue sky thinking, blue sky research, thinking about things for the sake of curiosity, as opposed to having like a real structured hypothesis based on it. And so it's used a lot now, but originally it was related to this term for like cons, which is pretty crazy. Whereas, so these negative connotations have certainly turned into positive connotations nowadays. So definitely one that started off as a bit of a joke, but now is actually used.
I don't know if either of you are on the competitor to X, which has a...
Of course, yes.
Isn't it?
I wonder if they had heard about this before they chose that name. They settled on that name. I suppose it doesn't matter even if they had. Like, it's... As I say, the word itself is now... The meaning has changed, I guess.
Exactly. Even if they had done, I mean... It'd be as humorous, isn't it? It could even be seen as like a dig towards X.
Yeah, that's true.
So
that was Twitter, and it was a blue bird as well. So maybe that was just...
Well, that's true. Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah. Blue sky thinking. Don't feel ashamed, even if it is a bit corporate-y.
That does sound like a very... I feel like that's typical of the corporate world in terms of corporate speech. Take something derogatory like that and turn it into positive... crap language, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, what other ones are like that? Like, oh yeah, we're going to take this offline. What do you mean? No, online's good.
Yeah.
What do you mean? You want to unplug us? Yeah. Oh god, corporate. I mean, we could do a whole episode on corporate speech.
We should. I hate that term so much. We'll circle back to that.
Let's pencil that one in for later.
just ping me a message and then.
Okay. I'd be really curious to, like, if anyone's done any kind of like psychology behind that. Like, where does that come? Where does corporate speak come from, and like the evolution of it as well? Like, what was corporate speak 100 years ago compared to like today? Yeah. What corporate speak has stood the test of time? Where's Circle Back and the origins of that?
I got a great email a few weeks ago. I'm not going to say who it's from or whatever, for obvious reasons. But
it was me. You're going to read my email.
I sent a long email about, like, you know, the processes of certain things, right? Yeah. And the email I got was just wheels up.
Wow.
That was it. Like, which I think means kind of like the play, like a plane going. So it's let's get on with it. Yeah. That was it. Two words, wheels up. Okay. Fine.
I'm going to use that now a lot in our chat, the three of us, you know, where we talk about like podcast topics and stuff behind the scenes. I'm going to use that a lot whenever it's like, oh, you free for an episode tonight? Wheels up.
I know, I loved it. And to be honest, I loved it because it was so to the point. And I don't know, people just, you know, giving fluff. So I loved it. But also it was quite funny.
Nice.
I mean,
nice.
That sounds like a full endorsement of every single thing that you listed in your email.
That was the other thing, yeah.
Every single thing you said.
Yeah.
Oh, nice. Oh, Alex, have you got any other terms for us?
Well, this is a little tidbit. I don't know if this counts in or is exactly the same as what the topic is, but basically when a mineral is discovered, the people that discover it have a chance to name it. Sometimes it's from the person who found it, or it's from the locale where it was first observed. Mineral names have a tendency to have "ite" on the end of them, you know, magnesite, hermatite,
marmite,
fluorite, apatite, amazonite, I think is another one. So anyway, there was one, that was discovered in the town of Cummington, Massachusetts.
Great name.
And it was named after its locale.
Robin.
So you can put those together. So
coming tonight. Oh my God.
Very good. Very good.
There you go. Well done.
I can't believe that. And Americans as well, because you bet. Like, American scientists of all people are going to be the ones with the worst sense of double entendre, you know.
Just... I didn't even realize. Yeah. I mean, this was a town called Cummington. You know, hilarity was going to ensue. Yeah. But I guess we have loads of those kind of town names.
We do. Oh, yeah,
I can't judge them for that.
More excuses, because, you know, ours go back thousands of years.
Whereas that's meant something different.
That's barely 200 years old. Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so good. Thank you, Alex. That's made my night. That's really wow. Gonna go to bed laughing. Oh, So on a different note, but going back to like things that started as jokes, slightly more obscure term, but you may have heard of it. Certainly, I think everyone will know what it means, which is a chronometer. Have you heard that term before?
I've heard of it. Please do remind.
It is a combination of the Greek chronos and meter. Chronos meaning time, and meter being a thing what measures stuff. So a chronometer is today a watch, but not just any watch. It's like those really fine mechanical watches. And in fact, Swiss watches...
One of the ones I can't afford.
Exactly, yeah. And Swiss watches are probably the finest of the finest. And their whole independent body who kind of certificate the highest quality watches to say that they are the most accurate watches in the world is the Contrôle Officiel Suisse des Chronomètres. So the official Swiss Chronometer Testing Institute in English. So it literally has the word chronometer in the body that regulates watches. And again, the term chronometer has just applied to incredibly accurate watches for hundreds of years now. And the first time it was used to specifically describe an accurate watch is like 1782 or something like that by a English watchmaker who I think was called John Arnold. Anyway, the term itself, though, chronometer, doesn't go back to ancient Greece, even though that's its roots. The earliest recorded instance of the word chronometer is from 1714, and it was used to describe in a pamphlet the first chronometers, which were actually clocks built for ships. And you've probably seen them, you know, in Pirates of the Caribbean or any other kind of historical adventure. You get those. They look like compasses, and they're in the middle of a ship. Usually they're contained in a kind of little stall, and they bob around as the ship moves. Yeah. They stay level because they're in a gyroscope, and that's a chronometer. And the whole point of a chronometer was invented to keep time as ships traveled long distances so they could determine the longitude of their position. Because latitude and longitude is how ships find out where they are in the world. And latitude is easy to determine because it's just a straight line from, around the world. Longitude is tough because it's measured in hours and minutes, determined from where you started, basically. So the reason you use a clock to measure your longitude is you need to know what time it is where you left, you know? So if you leave London heading for America, you find out your position in the massive Atlantic Ocean by finding out the time it is in London and the time of day is where you are. And you can determine that by looking at the sun. You know, if it's midday, it's going to be at the highest point. And if you look at the clock and it says, oh, it's 3 PM in London, then you know you've traveled a certain distance because of the time difference. So it
sounds incredibly complicated.
How did they work?
It is. It's all maths based. But the problem
I shouldn't be doing this.
The problem is that no clocks were accurate enough. All mechanical clocks lose time.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes they lose seconds, sometimes they lose minutes a day. So ships had a real problem determining longitude, and it got so bad that if you miscalculate your longitude by just a few seconds, you could crash into rocks that you thought weren't there. So there was a big disaster in 1707 where a fleet of 5 Navy ships were lost. They sank and nearly 2,000 sailors died because they'd got their longitude wrong.
What?
And they crashed into the Isle of Scilly in the channel because they just thought they were just, the commander, the admiral, didn't realize they were just a few seconds out. He thought they were closer to France than they were, and they just crashed into Scilly Isles and sank in a fog. So after this disaster, the British, who are obviously a big naval power, were like, we need to find longitude. No, we need to figure this out. This is a problem that needs solving. So in 1714, they put out a prize, £20,000 to... Whoever figured out a device that could calculate longitude accurately. And they set some rules and they said it can't lose more than 2 seconds a day or something like that. The idea being that, you know, you could travel to the edge of the British Empire, which is basically America, Before you lost so much time that you'd start crashing into things. They said, if you can get to America without crashing, that's basically it. So you can lose 2 seconds a day, was basically what they said. And they offered this huge prize, £20,000, which I think is like the equivalent of a few million today.
Yeah, that must be a crazy,
massive amount of money. So obviously, people came out of the woodwork suggesting their solutions. And some of them were crazy. Like some people said you could determine longitude by getting a dog to bark. Like if you trained a dog to bark at the same time every day in London, then on your ship when you're near America, it would bark every day at midday
to the second
in London.
That's amazing.
And of course, like that's not going to happen. That doesn't work. And
why don't you just bark the same time every day?
Like there was someone else suggested a solution, which was to basically have ships permanently moored at regular intervals all the way across the Atlantic Ocean, so that as you're sailing, those ships that were permanently moored to the spot would fire a cannon every hour or every midday or something, so you could hear them if you were sailing by. But of course there are problems with that, because the first problem was, it was like, no other nation, which nation is going to be responsible for having these ships permanently moored across the Atlantic, and which nations are going to tolerate this random ship just firing a cannon at them, you know? Not to mention the fact
the upkeep.
That once you get to the middle of the
Atlantic,
how long
would they last?
You get to like the Marianas Trench and stuff like that, and it's like you can't, like your anchor is not going to reach the bottom of the ocean. These ships are just going to drift wildly. And then it was just like, well, how do you supply these ships? The poor people who crew these ships that are just permanently moored in the middle of the Atlantic.
Yes.
You know, outrageous. Anyway, so this pamphlet was published by this scientist called Jeremy Thacker. And in it, he uses the term chronometer to describe what was the gyroscope that you see now on ships. Obviously, it was they've become more advanced since then. But at the time, like his design was like a real thing. However, the title of this pamphlet was "The Longitudes Examined," beginning with a short epistle to the longitudinarians and ending with a description of a smart, pretty machine of my own, which I am almost sure will do for the longitude and procure me £20,000. So already, like, this is a bit of
confident.
Interesting title. And he concludes it when he's describing, he spends the pamphlet describing all these other ideas and saying these are all nonsense. And then before he moves on to describing his design, he says, "In a word, I am satisfied that my reader begins to think that the phonometers, pyrometers, selenometers, heliometers, barometers, and all the meters are not worthy to be compared with my chronometer." So it's clearly a play on words. He's just taken all these other people's designs and they've added the word meter and combined it with something else. And he's just stuck chrono onto the beginning of it.
He's one part inventor and three parts ad man, basically. This should just be on he's doing a Dragon's Den presentation.
But so for all this time, this design actually did have some merit and was taken on and became the chronometer that we know today. So there's actually some real science in this pamphlet. And everyone's assumed that Jeremy Thacker was a real scientist who invented this chronometer and published this pamphlet, but maybe it was tongue-in-cheek. But in 2011, an author called Pat Rogers was doing research on onto satire, and he liked the satirical elements of this chronometer leaflet. And as he looked into it, he thought, there's no record anywhere of Jeremy Thacker. Who is this person? So he looked into it, and there's no record of his birth, no record of him ever getting married, no record of a scientist called Jeremy Thacker, nobody who went into business under that name, Jeremy Thacker. No trace of this Jeremy Thacker outside of this pamphlet exists. So he looked into it and found out that based on the style and based on the knowledge, because there's some real science in this pamphlet, this author, Pat Rogers, determined that Jeremy Thacker was in fact Dr. John Arbuthnot, who was a real physician and mathematician, and he was a member of the Scriblerus Group Club, which is a bunch of satirists, who included Jonathan Swift, who wrote Gulliver's Travels, and Alexander Pope, who most famously wrote a poem called The Rape of the Lock. And so basically, the word chronometer was not just a joke in this pamphlet, but also a joke in a pamphlet that was itself just a joke created by this satirist, who happened to be good, good enough at science that he perhaps inadvertently invented something that became useful because it was adapted into the chronometer in the movie, and he lent the name to it. So yeah, that was a slightly long-winded story to get to explain the joke. But there you go. Chronometer today. If you're a person who likes fancy watches, you probably have a chronometer, and that whole term was a joke within a joke.
Fantastic. Wow. My very God. Good.
That's
jokeception.
Jokeception. Yeah.
Wow.
That's a fun one.
Wow. Just,
as an aside, this whole ception thing. Someone I was talking to, I made that joke the other day, and it was to a much younger person who had not seen Inception and was just like, what do you mean by that? And I explained it. And I thought, oh, wait a second, Inception came out 15 years ago.
I know.
Don't say that.
Yeah.
When will we stop saying Inception? I hope it has as long a memory as Watergate. We stick gate onto things and sticks around. I hope Inception onto a word sticks around. Anyway, that's just an aside. So yeah, fellas,
Do you think it has crossed into that threshold of like it's going to outlive the film and the, do you know what I mean? Like, has it just become like a
I think so.
That
I think so.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. You'll be in a dictionary, encyclopedias in 100 years' time. Origins of this phrase. And like, the 2010 film, Inception. And people are like, oh, what's that? Anyway, any other scientific terms that started as jokes?
Oh, Leonardo DiCaprio. Is he that 130-year-old man that was still going out with 19-year-olds?
Quite possibly, yeah. But then,
he's definitely in a position to live longer than most people, thanks to all the technologies that he's got access to. His incredible wealth.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
I don't think there's any that can top that, Robin. I think that was great.
Oh,
yes. Agreed. A good one to finish up with on that one.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And thank you all lovely listeners for joining us. And speaking of you lovely listeners, any comments that we'd like to conclude this episode with, that we'd like to respond to, from our lovely watchers on YouTube and listeners on other podcast platforms of their choice. I know that I've got one, but it's kind of, the context is kind of specific, but I might as well go for it.
Okay.
It's from Alex Truman 979 on our last episode, which was called Are We About to Discover Alien Life? And it was about some exciting news about the probability of alien life increasing. And I don't remember what we said, Alex. It was you and me in that episode. But I guess we asked a question because Alex Truman says, Indian cuisine is the best.
I think we must have asked people what their favorite cuisine is, what their favorite food. I think that's the context.
So thank you, Alex Truman 979, and keep them coming.
Indian cuisine is very, very good.
What's your
go-to curry of choice if you're getting an Indian takeaway?
Vegetable dansak for me.
I've been going for a dipiatta over the last couple of years.
I haven't tried that. What's that one?
It's one that has like it's quite chunky. It has like chunky onion, chunky tomato in it.
Oh, I like that. I tend to go for a Rogan Josh, which also has Rogan Josh chunky, good. Chunky, bits in as well.
I mean, it took me a while to go for the. So there's a really, really good one, and it's lamb. It's like a curried lamb on the bone. But I never went for it for years because it was called railway mutton, and I was like, that just sounds like sheep's been hit by a train, and it was like I scraped it up and I put it in a curry. But I bit the bullet, and good. So see railway mutton.
Yeah. I've never seen that one.
No,
I haven't heard of that one.
Sounds I've seen a couple of times. Good one. Yeah. Nice. Indians up there, though, definitely.
Well, I'll say my comment as well, because it goes along with that. And this was from Andrew Winchester 895, who was also one of our YouTube members. So thank you. Thank you for supporting the channel. But they just say, and I love the way that they've just said this, so matter of fact, favorite food, large doner, chicken pakora, extra portion of chili sauce, as always to be consumed after 10 pints. Andrew, Andrew, no notes from me. That's 10 out of 10. Fully agree. Yeah. Full agreement there.
10 pints.
Wow.
Extra portion of chili sauce as well. This is a person who knows what they're about. And do you know what? I really respect that.
That's a person who always remembers to buy enough toilet roll and trusts his toilet seat.
Yeah, yeah.
Extra part of chili sauce, 10 pints. Jesus.
We've all been there. We've all been there. I know for a fact you've both been there.
Why do we? very good.
Yeah.
My comment or comments is just what the hell have you been saying about me, guys? Because I've got a couple of comments from this one. One from Vivian Circle that says, perfect timing, lads. I laugh so hard thinking about Martin going into witness protection. And then the other one saying, not impressed with Martin after the SA allegations. What?
SA? Whoa.
God, what?
Some allegations. I mean, what the hell did you say about me in the last episode? I don't think we said
anything. That's weird. That rings, it doesn't ring a bell at all.
That doesn't ring any bell.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Some left field.
I mean, it's normally a Daniel Radcliffe thing. I don't think Daniel Radcliffe's been accused of anything, has he?
No, I don't think so. And witness protection as well. So,
I mean, that's
an interesting one.
I don't know where that came from. Shall we tell them, or just save it for next?
Was that because Daniel? It was something to do with J.K. Rowling, wasn't it?
And, yeah, J.K. And got. And, she won. She didn't win. The law decided in her side's.
Oh thing. Yes, yeah, yeah.
And so Martin went into witness protection because she's out for Daniel Radcliffe.
Yeah. It was a bit of a stretch, that one, but it worked.
Really, really worked.
It was necessary. I've still got the images lined up, by the way. That was a pleasant surprise when I opened the graphics for this episode. I'm like, oh, yeah, Daniel Radcliffe. Anyway,
ridiculous.
Sorry, Martin. We never say anything particularly bad about you when you're not here.
Oh well, thank you. It's very kind.
Yeah.
We just tell the truth, Martin. That's all we do. We just speak the truth to power. Yeah.
There you go.
And on that note, thank you so much for joining me.
This has been a
great, fun little chat, and I hope you all at home listening to us have enjoyed this too. And we shall see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at kosai.org.
Hey, it's Austin James. If you're like me, trying to live your best life while living with diabetes, you can relate to worrying if you're doing a good job managing your diabetes. I use the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor to get real-time glucose readings and see the impact of every meal and activity to make better decisions. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor can help me live life with diabetes on my own terms, and it gives me more time for the things I love, like being a dad and a musician. Now this is progress. Learn more at freestylelibre.us.
For prescription only. Safety info found at freestylelibre.us.